Side 2. Domes of Fire. The Tomilly, Book 1. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 43. Khalad came to his feet with his eyes slightly unfocused, and with a thin dribble of blood coming out of his nose.
"You see? You overextended again," Mirtai told him.
"How did you do that?"
Sparhawk's squire asked her.
"I'll show you. Calton, come here."
"Not me,"
the blonde Pandion refused, backing away.
"Don't be foolish. I'm not going to hurt you."
"Isn't that what you told Khalad before you bounced him off the flagstones?"
"You might as well do as I tell you, Calton," she said. "You'll wind up doing it in the end anyway, and it won't be nearly as painful for you if you don't argue with me. Take out your sword and stab me in the heart with it."
"I don't want to hurt you, Mirtai."
"You hurt me?"
Her laugh was sardonic.
"You don't have to be insulting about it," he said in an injured tone, drawing his sword.
It had all begun when Mirtai had passed through the palace courtyard while Calton was giving Khalad some instruction in swordsmanship. She had made a couple of highly unflattering comments. One thing had led to another, and the end result had been this impromptu training session, during which Calton and Khalad were learning humility, if nothing else.
"Stab me through the heart, Calton," Mirtai said again. In Calton's defense, it should be noted in passing that he really did try. He made a great deal of noise when he came down on his back on the flagstones.
"He made the same mistake you did," Mirtai pointed out to Khalad. "He straightened his arm too much. A straight arm is a locked arm. Always keep your elbow slightly bent."
"We're trained to thrust from the shoulder, Mirtai," Khalad explained.
"There are a lot of Alines, I suppose," she shrugged. "It shouldn't be all that hard to replace you. The thing that makes me curious is why you all feel that it's necessary to stick your sword all the way through somebody. If you haven't hit the heart with the first 6 inches of the blade, another yard or so of steel going through the same hole won't make much difference, will it?"
"Maybe it's because it looks dramatic," Khalad said.
"You kill people for show? That's contemptible, and it's the sort of thinking that fills graveyards. Always keep your blade free, so that you're ready for your next enemy. People fold up when you run swords through them, and then you have to kick the body off the blade before you can use it again."
"I'll try to remember that."
"I hope so. I rather like you, and I hate burying friends."
She bent, professionally peeled Calton's eyelid back, and glanced at his glazed eyeball.
"You'd better throw a bucket of water on our friend here," she suggested,
nodding to Sparhawk as he joined them.
"He hasn't learned how to fall yet. We'll go into that next time."
"Next time?"
"Of course. If you're going to learn how to do this, you'd better learn how to do it right."
She gave Sparhawk a challenging look.
"Would you like to try?"
she asked him. No, Mirtai, not right now. Thanks all the same, though." She went on into the palace, looking just slightly pleased with herself.
"You know, I don't think I really want to be a knight after all, Sparhawk," Talon said from nearby. "It looks awfully painful. Where have you been? My wife's got people out looking for you."
"Yes, I saw them blundering around out in the streets. I had to go visit Platymy in the cellar."
"Oh?"
"He picked up something he thought you ought to be aware of. You know those unauthorized bandits in the hills near Cardos?"
"Not personally, no."
"Funny, Sparhawk, very funny.
Platymy's found out that somebody we know is sort of directing their activities."
"Oh? Who's that?"
"Can you believe that it's Krager?"
"You should have killed him when you had the chance, Sparhawk."
Chapter 3. The fog drifted in from the river not long after the sun went down that evening. The nights in Samora were always foggy in the spring when it wasn't raining. Sparhawk, Stragan, and Talon left the palace wearing plain clothing and heavy traveler's cloaks and rode to the southeast quarter of town.
"You don't necessarily have to tell your wife I said this, Sparhawk,"
Stragan noted, looking around with distaste.
But her capital is one of the least attractive cities in the world. You've got a truly miserable climate here. It's not so bad in the summertime, Sparhawk replied a little defensively. I missed last summer, the blonde thief said. I took a short nap one afternoon and slept right through it. Where are we going?
We want to see Platymy.
As I recall, his cellar's near the west gate of the city. You're taking us in the wrong direction.
We have to go to a certain inn first.
Sparhawk looked back over his shoulder. Are we being followed, Talon? He asked.
Naturally.
Sparhawk grunted. That's more or less what I expected.
They rode on with the thick mist swirling around the legs of their horses and making the fronts of the nearby houses dim and hazy-looking. They reached the inn on Rose Street, and a surly-appearing porter admitted them to the inn-yard and closed the gate behind them.
Anything you find out about this place isn't for general dissemination, Sparhawk told Talon and Stragan as he dismounted.
He handed Farron's reins to the porter.
You know about this horse, don't you, brother? He warned the man.
He's a legend, Sparhawk, the porter replied. The things you wanted are in the room at the top of the stairs.
How's the crowd in the tavern tonight?
Loud, smelly, and mostly drunk.
There's nothing new about that. What I meant, though, was how many of them are there?
15 or 20. There are 3 of our men in there who know what to do.
Good. Thank you, Sir Knight.
You're welcome, Sir Knight.
Sparhawk led Talon and Stragan up the stairs. This inn, I gather, isn't altogether what it seems, Stragan observed.
The Pandions own it, Talon told him. They come here when they don't want to attract attention.
There's a little more to it than that, Sparhawk told him.
He opened the door at the top of the stairs, and the 3 of them entered. Stragan looked at the workmen's smocks hanging on pegs near the door.
We're going to resort to subterfuge, I see. It's fairly standard practice.
Sparhawk shrugged.
Let's get changed. I'd sort of like to get back to the palace before my wife sends out search parties.
The smocks were of blue canvas, worn and patched, and with a few artfully placed smudges on them. There were woolen leggings as well, and thick-soled workman's boots. The caps were baggy affairs, designed more to keep off weather than they were for appearance.
You're going to have to leave that here, Sparhawk said, pointing at Stragan's rapier. It's a little obvious.
The big Pandion tucked a heavy dagger under his belt. You know that there are people watching the gate of the inn, don't you, Sparhawk? Talon said.
I hope they enjoy their evening. We aren't going out through the gate, though.
Sparhawk led them back down to the inn-yard, crossed to a narrow door in a side wall, and opened it. The warm air that boiled out through the doorway smelled of stale beer and unwashed bodies. The 3 of them went inside and closed the door behind them. They seemed to be in a small storeroom. The straw on the floor was moldy. Where are we? Talon whispered.
In a tavern, Sparhawk replied softly. There's going to be a fight in just a few minutes. We'll slip out into the main room during the confusion.
He went to the curtained doorway leading out into the tavern and twitched the curtain several times. All right, he whispered. We'll mingle with the crowd during the fight, and after a while we'll leave. Behave as if you're slightly drunk, but don't overdo it.
I'm impressed, Stragan said.
I'm more than impressed, Talon added. Not even Platymy knows that there's more than one way out of that inn. The fight began not long after that. It was noisy, involving a great deal of shouting and pushing, and finally a few blows. 2 totally uninvolved and evidently innocent bystanders were knocked senseless during the course of the altercation. Sparhawk and his friends smoothly insinuated themselves into the crowd, and after 10 minutes or so, they reeled out through the door.
A little unprofessional, Stragan sniffed. A staged fight shouldn't involve the spectators that way. It should when the spectators might be looking for something other than a few tankards of ale, Sparhawk disagreed. The 2 who fell asleep weren't regular patrons in the tavern. They might have been completely innocent,
but then again they might not. This way we don't have to worry about them trailing along behind us.
There's more to being a Pandion Knight than I thought, Talon noted. I may like it after all.
They walked through the foggy streets toward the run-down quarter near the west gate, a maze of interconnecting lanes and unpaved alleys. They entered one of those alleys and went through it to a flight of muddy stone stairs leading down. A thick-bodied man lounged against the stone wall beside the stairs.
You're late, he said to Talon in a flat voice.
We had to make sure we weren't being followed, the boy responded.
Go on down, the man told them. Platymy's waiting.
The cellar hadn't changed. It was still smoky and dim, and it was filled with a babble of coarse voices coming from the thieves, whores, and cutthroats who lived there.
I don't know how Platymy can stand this place.
Stragan shuddered. Platymy sat enthroned on a large chair on the other side of a smoky fire burning in an open pit. He heaved himself to his feet when he saw Sparhawk.
Where have you been?
He bellowed in a thunderous voice.
Making sure that we weren't followed, Sparhawk replied.
The fat man grunted.
He's back here, he said,
leading them toward the rear of the cellar.
He's very interested in his health at the moment, so I'm keeping him more or less out of sight.
He pushed his way into a small closet-like chamber, where a man sat on a stool, nursing a tankard of watery beer. The man was a small, nervous-looking fellow, with thinning hair and a cringing manner.
This is Pelk, Platymy said. He's a sneak thief. I sent him to Cardo's to have a look around and to see what he could find out about some people we're interested in. Tell him what you found out, Pelk.
Well, sir, good masters, the weedy man began. It took me a goodly while to get close to them fellers, I'll tell the world, but I made myself useful, and they finally sort of accepted me. They was all sorts of rigmarole I had to go through, swearing oaths and getting blindfolded the first couple of times they took me to the other camp and all, but after a while, they kind of let down their guard, and I come and went pretty much as I pleased. Like Platymy probably told you, we figured at first they was just a bunch of amateurs, what didn't know nothing about the ways things is supposed to be did. We sees that sort of thing all the time, don't we, Platymy? Them's the kind as gets theirselves caught and hung.
And good riddance to them, Platymy growled.
Well, sir, Pelk continued, like I say, me and Platymy, we figured as how them fellers in the mountings was just a bunch of them amateurs I told you about, fellers what had took up cutting throats for fun and profit, don't you know? As she turns out, howsomever, they was more than that. Their leaders was 6 or 7 noblemen as was real disappointed about the way the big plans of the primate Anias fell on their faces, and they was powerful unhappy about what the queen had writ down on the warrants she put out for them, nobles not being accustomed to being called them sort of names. Well, sir, short it up some, these here noblemen all run off into the mountings about one jump ahead of the hangman, and they tuck to robbing travelers to make ends meet and spent the rest of their time thinking up nasty names to call the queen.
Get to the point, Pelk, Platymy told him wearily.
Yes, sir, I was just about to. Well, now, it went on like that for a spell, and then this here Krager feller, he come into camp, and some of them there nobles, they knowed him. He told them as how he knowed some furriners as would help them out if and they raise enough fuss here in Alenia to keep the queen and her folks from getting too curious about some stuff what's going on off in Lamorkand. This here Krager feller, he says as how this stuff in Lamorkand might just could be a way for them all to change the way their fortune's been going since old Anias got hisself killed. Well, sir, them dukes and earls and such got real interested at that point, and they told us all to go talk to the local peasants and to start running down the tax collectors and to say as how it ain't natural for no country to be run by no woman and the like. We was supposed to stir up them peasants and to get 'em to talking among theirselves about how the people ought to all get together and throw the queen out and the like. And then them nobles, they caught a few tax collectors and hung 'em and give the money back to the folks it had been stole from in the first place. And them peasants, they was all happy as pigs in mud about that.
Pelk scratched at his head.
Well, sir, I guess I've said in peace now. That's the way she stands in the mountings now. This here Krager feller, he's got some money with him, and he's mighty free with it. So them nobles what's been on short rations is getting downright fond of him.
Pelk, Sparhawk told him, you're a treasure.
He gave the man several coins, and then he and his friends left the cubicle.
What are we going to do about it, Sparhawk?
Vladimir asked.
We are going to take steps, Sparhawk replied.
How many of these liberators are there?
100 or so.
I'll need a couple dozen of your men who know the country.
Vladimir nodded.
Are you going to bring in the army?
I don't think so. I think a troop of Pandions might make a more lasting impression on people who think they have grievances against our queen, don't you?
Isn't that just a bit extreme? Strachan asked him.
I want to make a statement, Strachan. I want everybody in Alenia to know just how much I disapprove of people who start plotting against my wife. I don't want to have to do it again, so I'm going to do it right the first time.
He didn't actually talk like that, did he, Sparhawk?
Ilana asked incredulously.
That's fairly close, Sparhawk told her. Stragan's got a very good ear for dialect.
It's almost hypnotic, isn't it? She marveled. And it goes on and on and on.
She suddenly grinned impishly.
Write down happy as pigs in mud, Linda. I may want to find a way to work that into some official communication.
As you wish, Your Majesty.
Linda's tone was neutral, but Sparhawk knew that the old courtier disapproved. What are we going to do about this? The Queen asked.
Sparhawk said that he was going to take steps, Your Majesty, Talon told her.
You might not want to know too many details. Sparhawk and I don't keep secrets from each other, Talon.
I'm not talking about secrets, Your Majesty, the boy replied innocently.
I'm just talking about boring, unimportant little things you shouldn't really waste your time on.
He made it sound very plausible, but Ilana looked more than a little suspicious.
Don't embarrass me, Sparhawk, she warned.
Of course not, he replied blandly.
The campaign was brief. Since Pelk knew the precise location of the camp of the dissidents, and Platymi's men knew all the other hiding places in the surrounding mountains, there was no real place for the bandits to run, and they were certainly no match for the 30 black-armored Pandions Sparhawk, Kalton, and Ulath led against them. The surviving nobles were held for the Queen's justice, and the rest of the outlaws were turned over to the local sheriff for disposition.
Well, my lord of Belton, Sparhawk said to an earl crouched before him on a log, with a blood-stained bandage around his head and his hands bound behind him. Things didn't turn out so well, did they?
Curse you, Sparhawk,
Belton spat, squinting up against the afternoon's brightness. How did you find out where we were?
My dear Belton, Sparhawk laughed, you didn't really think you could hide from my wife, did you? She takes a very personal interest in her kingdom. She knows every tree, every town and village, and all of the peasants. It's even rumored that she knows most of the deer by their first names.
Why didn't you come after us earlier, then? Belton sneered.
The queen was busy. She finally found the time to make some decisions about you and your friends. I don't imagine you'll care much for these decisions, old boy. What I'm really interested in is any information you might have about Krager. He and I haven't seen each other for quite some time, and I find myself yearning for his company again.
Belton's eyes grew frightened.
You won't get anything from me, Sparhawk, he blustered.
How much would you care to wager on that? Kalton asked him.
You'd save yourself a great deal of unpleasantness if you tell Sparhawk what he wants to know.
And Krager's not so lovable that you'd really want to go through that in order to protect him.
Just talk, Belton, Sparhawk insisted implacably. I can't.
Belton's sneering bravado crumbled.
His face turned deathly pale, and he began to tremble violently.
Sparhawk, I beg of you. It means my life if I say anything.
Your life isn't worth very much right now, anyway, Ulaf told him bluntly. One way or another, you are going to talk.
For God's sake, Sparhawk, you don't know what you're asking.
I'm not asking, Belton. Sparhawk's face was bleak. Then, without any warning or reason, a deathly chill suddenly enveloped the woods, and the mid-afternoon sun darkened. Sparhawk glanced upward. The sky was very blue, but the sun appeared wan and sickly. Belton screamed. An inky cloud seemed to spring from the surrounding trees, coalescing around the shrieking prisoner. Sparhawk jumped back with a startled oath, his hand going to his sword hilt. Belton's voice had risen to a screech, and there were horrible sounds coming from the now impenetrable darkness surrounding him, sounds of breaking bones and tearing flesh. The shrieking broke off quite suddenly, but the sounds continued for several eternal-seeming minutes. Then, as quickly as it had come, the cloud vanished. Sparhawk recoiled in revulsion. His prisoner had been torn to pieces.
Good God! Carlton gasped. What happened?
We both know, Carlton, Sparhawk replied. We've seen it before. Don't try to question any of the other prisoners. I'm almost positive they won't be allowed to answer. There were five of them. Sparhawk, Ilana, Carlton, Ulaf, and Stragan. They had gathered in the royal apartment, and their mood was bleak. Was it the same cloud? Stragan asked intently. There were some differences, Sparhawk replied, more in the way it felt than anything I could really pin down.
Why would the troll gods be so interested in protecting Craeger? Ilana asked, her face puzzled.
I don't think it's Craeger they're protecting, Sparhawk replied. I think it has something to do with what's going on in Lamorkand. He slammed his fist down on the arm of his chair. I wish Sephrenia were here. He burst out with a sudden oath. All we're doing is groping in the dark. Would you be opposed to logic at this point? Stragan asked him. I wouldn't even be opposed to astrology just now, Sparhawk replied sourly. All right.
The blonde Thalesian thief rose to his feet and began to pace up and down, his eyes thoughtful.
First of all, we know that somehow the troll gods have gotten out of that box. Actually, you haven't really proved that, Stragan, Ulaf disagreed. Not logically, anyway. Stragan stopped pacing. He's right, you know, he admitted. We've been basing that conclusion on a guess. All we can say with any logical certainty is that we've encountered something that looks and feels like a manifestation of the troll gods. Would you accept that, Sir Ulaf?
I suppose I could go that far, my Lord Stragan.
I'm so happy. Do we know of anything else that does the same sort of things?
No, Ulaf replied. But that's not really relevant. We don't know about everything. There could be dozens of things we don't know about that take the form of shadows or clouds, tear people all to pieces, and give humans a chilly feeling when they're around.
I'm not sure that logic is really getting us anywhere, Stragan conceded.
There's nothing wrong with your logic, Stragan, Ilana told him. Your major premise is faulty, that's all.
You too, Your Majesty? Carlton groaned. I thought there was at least one other person in the room who relied on common sense rather than all this tedious logic.
All right, Sir Carlton, she said tartly. What does your common sense tell you?
Well, first off, it tells me that you're all going at the problem backward.
The question we should be asking is what makes Craeger so special that something supernatural would go out of its way to protect him?
Does it really matter what the supernatural thing is at the moment?
He might have something there, you know, Ulaf said. Craeger's a cockroach, basically. His only real reason for existing is to be stepped on.
I'm not so sure. Ilana disagreed. Craeger worked for Martell,
and Martell worked for Anais.
Actually, dear, it was the other way around, Sparhawk corrected her. She waved that distinction aside.
Belton and the others were all allied to Anais, and Krager used to carry messages between Anais and Martell. Belton and his cohorts would almost certainly have known Krager. Pelk's story more or less confirms that. That's what made Krager important in the first place. She paused, frowning. But what made him important after the renegades were all in custody?
Backtracking, Uloth grunted.
I beg your pardon?
The Queen looked baffled. This whatever it is didn't want us to be able to trace Krager back to his present employer.
Well, that's obvious, Uloth, Colton snorted. His employer is Count Garrick. Pelk told Sparhawk that there was somebody in Lamorkand who wanted to keep us so busy here in Alenia that we wouldn't have time to take any steps to put down all the turmoil over there. That has to be Garrick.
You're just guessing, Colton, Uloth said. You could very well be right, but it's still just a guess.
Do you see what I mean about logic?
Colton demanded of them.
What do you want, Uloth? A signed confession from Garrick himself?
Do you have one handy? All I'm saying is that we ought to keep an open mind. I don't think we should close any doors yet, that's all.
There was a firm knock on the door, and it opened immediately afterward. Mirtai looked in.
Bevier and Tinian are here, she announced.
They're supposed to be in Rendor, Sparhawk said.
What are they doing here?
Why don't you ask them? Mirtai suggested pointedly. They're right out here in the corridor.
The two knights entered the room. Sir Bevier was a slim, olive-skinned Archean, and Sir Tinian, a blonde, burly Deirin. Both were in full armor.
How are things in Rendor? Colton asked them.
Hot, dry, dusty, hysterical, Tinian replied. Rendor never changes. You know that. Bevier dropped to one knee before Aelana. Despite the best efforts of his friends, the young Cyrenic knight was still painfully formal.
Your Majesty, he murmured respectfully.
Oh, do stand up, my dear Bevier, she smiled at him. We're friends, so there's no need for that. Besides, you creak like a rusty ironworks when you kneel.
Overtrained, perhaps, Your Majesty, he admitted.
What are you two doing back here? Sparhawk asked them.
Carrying dispatches, Tinian replied. Darylin's running things down there, and he wants the other preceptors kept abreast of things. We're also supposed to go on to Kyrellos and brief the archprelate.
How's the campaign going? Colton asked them.
Badly, Tinian shrugged. The Rendorish rebels aren't really organized, so there aren't any armies for us to meet. They hide amongst the population and come out at night to set fires and assassinate priests. Then they run back into their holes. We take reprisals the next day, burn villages, slaughter herds of sheep and the like. None of it really proves anything.
Do they have any kind of a leader as yet? Sparhawk asked.
They're still discussing that, Bevier said dryly. The discussions are quite spirited. We usually find several dead candidates in the alleys every morning.
Sarathi blundered, Tinian said.
Bevier gasped.
I'm not trying to offend your religious sensibilities, my young friend, Tinian said, but it's the truth. Most of the clergymen he sent to Rendor were much more interested in punishment than in reconciliation. We had a chance for real peace in Rendor, and it fell apart because Dolmont didn't send anybody down there to keep a leash on the missionaries. Tinian set his helmet on a table and unbuckled his sword belt. I even saw one silly ass in a cassock tearing the veils off women in the street. After the crowd seized him, he tried to order me to protect him. That's the kind of priests the church has been sending to Rendor.
What did you do? Stregan asked him.
For some reason, I couldn't quite hear what he was saying, Tinian replied. All the noise the crowd was making, more than likely.
What did they do to him? Colton grinned.
They hanged him. Quite a neat job, actually. You didn't even go to his defense? Bevier exclaimed.
Our instructions were very explicit, Vivier. We were told to protect the clergy against unprovoked attacks. That idiot violated the modesty of about a dozen Rendorish women. That crowd had plenty of provocation. The silly ass had it coming. If that crowd hadn't hanged him, I probably would have. That's what Darolin wants us to suggest to Sarathi. He thinks the church should pull all those fanatic missionaries out of Rendor until things quiet down. Then he suggests that we send in a new batch, a slightly less fervent one. The Alcyone knight laid his sword down beside his helmet and lowered himself into a chair. "What's been happening here?" he asked.
"Why don't the rest of you fill them in?" Sparhawk suggested. "There's someone I want to talk with for a few minutes."
He turned and quietly went back into the royal apartment. The person he wanted to talk with was not some court functionary, but rather his own daughter. He found her playing with her kitten. After some thought, Her Royal Little Highness had decided to name the small animal Myrrh, a sound that, when she uttered it, sounded so much like the kitten's purr that Sparhawk usually couldn't tell for sure which of them was making it. Princess Danae had many gifts. "We need to talk," Sparhawk told her, closing the door behind him as he entered.
"What is it now, Sparhawk?" she asked.
"Tinian and Bevier just arrived."
"Yes, I know."
"Are you playing with things again? Are you deliberately gathering all our friends here?"
"Of course I am, Father."
"Would you mind telling me why?"
"There's something we're going to need to do before long. I thought I'd save some time by getting everybody here in advance."
"You'd probably better tell me what it is that we have to do."
"I'm not supposed to do that."
"You never pay any attention to any of the other rules."
"This is different, Father. We're absolutely not supposed to talk about the future. If you think about it for a moment, I'm sure you'll see why." "Ouch!"
Myrrh had bitten her finger. Danae spoke sharply with the kitten, a series of little growls, a meow or two, and concluding with a forgiving purr. The kitten managed to look slightly ashamed of itself and proceeded to lick the injured finger.
"Please don't talk in cat, Danae," Sparhawk said in a pained tone. "If some chambermaid hears you, it'll take us both a month to explain."
"Nobody's going to hear me, Sparhawk. You've got something else on your mind, haven't you?"
"I want to talk with Sophronia. There are some things I don't understand, and I need her help with them."
"I'll help you, Father."
He shook his head.
"Your explanations always leave me with more questions than I had when we started. Can you get in touch with Sophronia for me?"
She looked around. "It probably wouldn't be a good idea here in the palace, Father," she told him. "It involves something that might be hard to explain if someone overheard us."
"You're going to be in two places at the same time again?"
"Well, sort of."
She picked up her kitten.
"Why don't you find some excuse to take me out for a ride tomorrow morning? We'll go out of the city, and I can take care of things there. Tell Mother that you want to give me a riding lesson."
"You don't have a pony, Danae."
She gave him an angelic smile.
"My goodness," she said. "That sort of means that you're going to have to give me one, doesn't it?"
He gave her a long, steady look.
"You were going to give me a pony eventually, weren't you, Father?"
She gave it a moment's thought.
"A white one, Sparhawk," she added. "I definitely want a white one."
Then she snuggled her kitten against her cheek, and they both started to purr. Sparhawk and his daughter rode out of Simura not long after breakfast the following morning. The weather was blustery, and Myrtai had objected rather vociferously until Princess Danae told her not to be so fussy. For some reason, the word fussy absolutely enraged the Tamil giantess. She stormed away, swearing sulphurously in her own language. It had taken Sparhawk hours to find a white pony for his daughter, and he was quite convinced after he had that it was the only white one in the whole town. When Danae greeted the stubby little creature like an old friend, he began to have a number of suspicions. Over the past couple of years, he and his daughter had painfully hammered out a list of the things she wasn't supposed to do. The process had begun rather abruptly in the palace garden one summer afternoon, when he had come around a box hedge to find a small swarm of fairies pollinating flowers under Danae's supervision.
Although she had probably been right when she had asserted that fairies were really much better at it than bees, he had firmly put his foot down. After a bit of thought this time, however, he decided not to make an issue of his daughter's obvious connivance in obtaining a specific pony. He needed her help right now, and she might point out, with a certain amount of justification, that to forbid one form of what they had come to call tampering, while encouraging another, was inconsistent.
"Is this going to involve anything spectacular?" he asked her when they were several miles out of town.
"How do you mean spectacular?"
"You don't have to fly or anything, do you?"
"It's awkward that way, but I can if you'd like."
"No, that's all right, Denny. What I'm getting at is, would you be doing anything that would startle travelers if we went out into this meadow a ways and you did whatever it is there?"
"They won't see a thing, Father," she assured him. "I'll race you to that tree out there." She didn't even make a pretense of nudging her pony's flanks, and despite Farron's best efforts, the pony beat him to the tree by a good 20 yards. The big roan warhorse glowered suspiciously at the short-legged pony when Sparhawk reined him in.
"You cheated," Sparhawk accused his daughter.
"Only a little." She slid down from her pony and sat cross-legged under the tree. She lifted her small face and sang in a trilling, flute-like voice. Her song broke off, and for several moments she sat blank-faced and absolutely immobile. She did not even appear to be breathing, and Sparhawk had the chilling feeling that he was absolutely alone, although she clearly sat not 2 yards away from him.
"What is it, Sparhawk?"
Danae's lips moved, but it was Sifrinia's voice that asked the question, and when Danae opened her eyes, they had changed. Danae's eyes were very dark. Sifrinia's were deep blue, almost lavender.
"We miss you, little mother," he told her, kneeling and kissing the palms of his daughter's hands.
"You called me from halfway around the world to tell me that? I'm touched, but..."
"It's something a little more, Sifrinia. We've been seeing that shadow again. The cloud, too."
"That's impossible."
"I sort of thought so myself, but we keep seeing them all the same. It's different, though. It feels different, for one thing. And this time, it's not just Elana and I who see it. Stragan and Ulaf saw it, too."
"You'd better tell me exactly what's been happening, Sparhawk." He went into greater detail about the shadow, and then briefly described the incident in the mountains near Cardos.
"Whatever this thing is," he concluded, "it seems very intent on keeping us from finding out what's going on in Lamorkand."
"Is there some kind of trouble there?"
"Count Garrick is raising a rebellion. He seems to think that the crown might fit him. He's even going so far as to claim that Drichtnoth's returned. That's ridiculous, isn't it?"
Her eyes grew distant. "Is this shadow you've been seeing exactly the same as the one you and Elana saw before?" she asked.
"It feels different somehow."
"Do you get that same sense that it has more than one consciousness in it?"
"That hasn't changed. It's a small group, but it's a group all the same. And the cloud that tore the Earl of Belton to pieces was definitely the same. Did the troll gods manage to escape from Belium somehow?"
"Let me think my way through it for a moment, Sparhawk," she replied. She considered it for a time. In a curious way, she was impressing her own appearance on Danae's face. "I think we may have a problem, dear one," she said finally.
"I noticed that myself, little mother."
"Stop trying to be clever, Sparhawk. Do you remember the Dawn Men who came out of that cloud up in Pelosia?"
Sparhawk shuddered. "I've been making a special point of trying to forget that."
"Don't discount the possibility that the wild stories about Drichtnoth may have some basis in fact. The troll gods can reach back in time and bring creatures and people forward to where we are now. Drichtnoth may very well indeed have returned."
Sparhawk groaned. "Then the troll gods have managed to escape, haven't they?"
"I didn't say that, Sparhawk. Just because the troll gods did this one time doesn't mean that they're the only ones who know how.
For all I know, Afriel could do it herself.
She paused.
You could have asked her these questions, you know.
Possibly. But I don't think I could have asked her this one, because I don't think she'd know the answer. She doesn't seem to be able to grasp the concept of limitations for some reason.
You've noticed,
she said dryly. Be nice. She's my daughter, after all.
She was my sister first, so I have a certain amount of seniority in the matter. What is it that she wouldn't be able to answer?
Could a Styric magician, or any other magician, be behind all this? Could we be dealing with a human?
No, Sparhawk, I don't think so. In 40,000 years, there have only been 2 Styric magicians who were able to reach back into time, and they could only do it imperfectly. For all practical purposes, what we're talking about is beyond human capability.
That's what I wanted to find out for sure. We're dealing with gods, then.
I'm afraid so, Sparhawk. Almost certainly.
Chapter 4
Preceptor Sparhawk, it is our hope that this finds you and your family in good health. A matter of some delicacy has arisen, and we find that your presence is required here in Kyrellos. You are therefore commanded by the Church to proceed forthwith to the Basilica, and to present yourself before our throne to receive our further instruction. We know that as a true son of the Church, you will not delay. We shall expect your attendance upon us within the week. Dolmont, Archprelate. Sparhawk lowered the letter and looked around at the others.
He gets right to the point, doesn't he? Carlton observed. Of course, Dolmont never was one to beat around the bush.
Queen Elana gave a howl of absolute fury and began beating her fists on the council table and stamping her feet on the floor.
You'll hurt your hands, Sparhawk cautioned.
How dare he? She exploded. How dare he?
A bit abrupt, perhaps, Stragan noted cautiously.
You will ignore this churlish command, Sparhawk, Elana ordered.
I can't do that.
You are my husband and my subject. If Dolmont wants to see you, he'll ask my permission. This is outrageous.
The Archprelate does, in fact, have the authority to summon the preceptor of one of the militant orders to Kyrellos, Your Majesty, the Earl of Lenda diffidently told the fuming queen.
You're wearing too many hats, Sparhawk, Tinian told his friend. You should resign from a few of these exalted positions you hold.
It's that devastating personality of his, Carlton said to Ulath, and all those unspeakable gifts. People just wither and die in his absence.
I forbid it,
Elana said flatly. I have to obey him, Elana, Sparhawk explained. I'm a church knight. Her eyes narrowed.
Very well, then, she decided. Since Dolmont's feeling so authoritarian, we'll all obey his stupid command. We'll go to Kyrellos and set up shop in the Basilica. I'll let him know that I expect him to provide me with adequate facilities and an administrative staff at his expense. He and I are going to have this out once and for all.
This promises to be one of the high points in the history of the Church, Stragan observed.
I'll make that pompous ass wish he'd never been born, Elana declared ominously.
Nothing Sparhawk might say could in any way change his wife's mind.
If the truth were to be known, however, he did not really try all that hard, because he could see her point. Dolmont was being high-handed. He tended at times to run roughshod over the kings of Eosia, and so the clash of wills between the Archprelate and the Queen of Alenia was probably inevitable. The unfortunate thing was that they were genuinely fond of each other, and neither of them was opposing the other out of petty vanity or pride. Dolmont was asserting the authority of the Church, and Elana that of the Alenian throne. They had become institutions instead of people. It was Sparhawk's misfortune to be caught in the middle. He was absolutely certain that the arrogant tone of the Archprelate's letter had not come from his friend, but from some half-drowsing scribe absent-mindedly scribbling formula phrases. What Dolmont had most probably said was something on the order of, "Send a letter to Sparhawk, and tell him I'd like to see him." That was not
however, what had arrived in Sumura. What had arrived had set Elana's teeth on edge, and she went out of her way to make the impending visit to Kyrellos as inconvenient for the archprelate as she possibly could. Her first step was to depopulate the palace. Everybody had to join her entourage. The queen needed ladies-in-waiting. The ladies-in-waiting needed maids. They all needed grooms and footmen. Lenda and Platymi, who were to remain in Sumura to maintain the government, were left almost unassisted.
"Looks almost like an army mobilizing, doesn't it?" Carlton said gaily as they came down the palace stairs on the morning of their departure.
"Let's hope the archprelate doesn't misunderstand," Ulaf murmured. "He wouldn't really believe your wife was planning to lay siege to the basilica, would he, Sparhawk?"
Once they left Sumura, the colorfully dressed Alenian court stretched out for miles under a blue spring sky. Had it not been for the steely glint in the queen's eyes, this might have been no more than one of those outings so loved by idle courtiers. Elana had suggested that Sparhawk, as acting preceptor of the Pandion Order, should also be suitably accompanied. They had haggled about the number of Pandions he should take with him to Kyrellos. He had held out at first for Carlton, Barrett, and perhaps one or two others, while the queen had been more in favor of bringing along the entire order. They had finally agreed upon a score of black-armored knights. It was impossible to make any kind of time with so large an entourage. They seemed almost to creep across the face of Alenia, plodding easterly to Lenda, and then southeasterly toward Deimos and Kyrellos. The peasantry took the occasion of their passing as an excuse for a holiday, and the road was usually lined with crowds of country people who had come out to gawk.
"It's a good thing we don't do this very often," Sparhawk observed to his wife not long after they had passed the city of Lenda.
"I rather enjoy getting out, Sparhawk." The queen and Princess Danae were riding in an ornate carriage drawn by 6 white horses.
"I'm sure you do, but this is the planting season. The peasants should be in the fields. Too many of these royal excursions could cause a famine."
"You really don't approve of what I'm doing, do you, Sparhawk?"
"I understand why you're doing it, Elana, and you're probably right. Dolmont needs to be reminded that his authority isn't absolute. But I think this particular approach is just a little frivolous."
"Of course it's frivolous, Sparhawk," she admitted quite calmly. "That's the whole point. In spite of all the evidence he's had to the contrary, Dolmont still thinks I'm a silly little girl. I'm going to rub his nose in silly for a while. Then, when he's good and tired of it, I'll take him aside and suggest that it would be much easier on him if he took me seriously. That should get his attention. Then we'll be able to get down to business."
"Everything you do is politically motivated, isn't it?"
"Well, not quite everything, Sparhawk." They stopped briefly in Deimos, and Khalad and Talon took the royal couple, Carlton, Danae, and Myrtai, to visit their mothers. As Slady and Elis mothered everyone impartially, Sparhawk strongly suspected that this was one of the main reasons his wife quite often found excuses to travel to Deimos. Her childhood had been bleak and motherless, and any time she felt insecure or uncertain, some reason seemed to come up why her presence in Deimos was absolutely necessary. Aslady's kitchen was warm, and its walls were hung with burnished copper pots. It was a homey sort of place, but seemed to answer some deep need in the Queen of Alenia. The smells alone were enough to banish most of the cares of all who entered it. Elis, Talon's mother, was a radiant blonde woman, and Aslady was a kind of monument to motherhood. They adored each other. Aslady had been Curic's wife, and Elis his mistress, but there appeared to be no jealousy between them. They were practical women, and they both realized that jealousy was a useless kind of thing that never made anyone feel good. Sparhawk and Carlton were immediately banished from the kitchen. Khalad and Talon were sent to mend a fence, and the Queen of Alenia and her Tamil slave continued their intermittent education in the art of cooking, while Aslady and Elis mothered Danae.
"I can't remember the last time I saw a queen kneading bread dough."
Carlton grinned as he and Sparhawk strolled around the familiar dooryard.
I think she's making pie crusts, Sparhawk corrected him. Dough is dough, Sparhawk. Remind me never to ask you to bake me a pie. No danger there.
Colton laughed.
Mirtai looks very natural, though. She's had lots of practice cutting things, and people, up. I just wish she wouldn't use her own daggers. You can never really be sure where they've been. She always cleans them after she stabs somebody.
It's the idea of it, Sparhawk. Colton shuddered. The thought of it makes my blood run cold.
Don't think about it, then.
You're going to be late, you know, Colton reminded his friend. Dolmont only gave you a week to get to Kyrellos.
It couldn't be helped. Do you want me to ride on ahead and let him know you're coming? And spoil the surprise my wife has planned for him? Don't be silly.
They were no more than a league southeast of Deimos the next morning when the attack came. 100 men, peculiarly dressed with strange weapons, burst over the top of a low knoll, bellowing war cries. They thundered forward on foot for the most part. The ones on horseback appeared to be their leaders. The courtiers fled, squealing in terror, as Sparhawk barked commands to his pandions. The 20 black-armored knights formed up around the queen's carriage and easily repelled the first assault. Men on foot are not really a match for mounted knights.
"What's the language?" Colton shouted. "Old Lamorc, I think," Ulath replied. "It's a lot like old Thalesian."
"Sparhawk," Mirtai barked, "don't give them time to regroup."
She pointed her blood-smeared sword at the attackers milling around at the top of the knoll.
"She's got a point," Tinian agreed.
Sparhawk quickly assessed the situation, deployed some of his knights to protect Aelana, and formed up the remainder of his force.
"Charge!"
he roared. It is the lance that makes the armored knight so devastating against foot troops. The man on foot has no defense against it, and he cannot even flee. A third of the attackers had fallen in the initial assault, and a score fell victim to the lances during Sparhawk's charge. The knights then fell to work with swords and axes. Bevier's Lochaber axe was particularly devastating, and he left wide tracks of the dead and dying through the tightly packed ranks of the now confused attackers. It was Mirtai, however, who stunned them all with a shocking display of sheer ferocity. Her sword was lighter than the broadswords of the church knights, and she wielded it with almost the delicacy of Stragan's rapier. She seldom thrust at an opponent's body, but concentrated instead on his face and throat, and, when necessary, his legs. Her thrusts were short and tightly controlled, and her slashes were aimed not at muscles, but rather at tendons. She crippled more than she killed, and the shrieks and groans of her victims raised a fearful din on that bloody field. The standard tactic of armored knights when deployed against foot troops was to charge with their lances first, and then to use the weight of their horses to crush their unmounted opponents together so tightly that they become tangled with their comrades. Once they had been rendered more or less helpless, slaughtering them would be easy work.
"Ulath!" Sparhawk shouted. "Tell them to throw down their weapons."
"I'll try," Ulath shouted back. Then he roared something incomprehensible at the milling foot troops.
A mounted man wearing a grotesquely decorated helmet bellowed something in reply.
"That one with the wings on his helmet is the leader, Sparhawk," Ulath said, pointing with his bloody axe.
"What did he say?"
Colton demanded.
"He made some uncomplimentary remarks about my mother. Excuse me for a moment, gentlemen. I really ought to do something about that."
He wheeled his horse and approached the man with the winged helmet, who was also armed with a war axe. Sparhawk had never seen an axe fight before, and he was somewhat surprised to note that there was far more finesse involved than he had imagined. Sheer strength accounted for much, of course, but sudden changes of the direction of swings implied a level of sophistication Sparhawk had not expected. Both men wore heavy round shields, and the defenses they raised with them were more braced than might have been the case had they been attacking each other with swords. Ulath stood up in his stirrups and raised his axe high over his head. The warrior in the winged helmet raised his shield to protect his head, but the huge Thalesian swung his arm back, rolled his shoulder, and delivered an underhand blow instead, catching his opponent just under the ribs. The leader of the attackers doubled over sharply, clutching at his stomach, and then he fell from his saddle. A vast groan rolled through the ranks of the attackers still on their feet, and then, like a mist caught by a sudden breeze, they wavered and vanished.
"Where did they go?" Barrett shouted, looking around with alarm.
But no one could answer. Where there had been 20 foot troops before, there was now nothing, and a sudden silence fell over the field as the shrieking wounded also vanished. Only the dead remained, and even they were strangely altered. Their bodies were peculiarly desiccated, dry, shrunken, and withered. The blood that had covered their limbs was no longer bright red, but black, dry, and crusty.
"What kind of spell could do that, Sparhawk?" Tinian demanded.
"I have no idea," Sparhawk replied in some bafflement. "Someone's playing, and I don't think I like the game."
"Bronze!"
Bevier exclaimed from nearby. The young Cyrenic knight had dismounted and was examining the armor of one of the shriveled dead.
"They're wearing bronze armor, Sparhawk. Their weapons and helmets are steel, but this mail shirt is made out of bronze."
"What's going on here?" Carlton demanded.
"Barrett," Sparhawk said, "ride back to the mother house at Demos. Gather up every brother who can still wear armor. I want them here before noon."
"Right," Barrett replied crisply. He wheeled his horse and galloped back the way they had come. Sparhawk looked around quickly.
"Up there," he said, pointing at a steep hill on the other side of the road. "Let's gather up this crowd and get them to the top of that hill. Put the courtiers and grooms and footmen to work. I want ditches up there, and I want to see a forest of sharpened stakes sprouting on the sides of that hill. I don't know where those men in bronze armor went, but I want to be ready in case they come back." "You can't order me around like that," an overdressed courtier exclaimed to Halad in an outraged tone of voice. "Don't you know who I am?"
"Of course I do," Sparhawk's young squire replied in an ominous tone of voice. "You're the man who's going to pick up that shovel and start digging. Or, if you prefer, you can be the man who's crawling around on his hands and knees picking up his teeth."
Halad showed the courtier his fist. The courtier could hardly miss seeing it, since it was about an inch in front of his nose.
"It's almost like old times, isn't it?" Carlton laughed. "Halad sounds exactly like Kirik."
Sparhawk sighed.
"Yes," he agreed soberly. "I think he's going to work out just fine. Get the others, Carlton. We need to talk."
They gathered beside Elana's carriage. The queen was a bit pale, and she was holding her daughter in her arms.
"All right," Sparhawk said. "Who were they?"
"Lamb orcs, evidently," Ulaf said.
"I doubt that anybody else would be able to speak old Lamb orc."
"But why would they be speaking in that language?" Tinian asked. "Nobody's spoken in old Lamorc for 1,000 years.
"And nobody's worn bronze armor for even longer," Bevier added.
"Somebody's using a spell I've never even heard of before," Sparhawk said. "What are we dealing with here?"
"Isn't that obvious?" Stragan said. "Somebody's reaching back into the past, the same way the troll gods did in Pelosia. We've got a powerful magician of some kind out there who's playing games."
"It fits," Ulaf grunted. "They were speaking an antique language, they had antique weapons and equipment, they weren't familiar with modern tactics, and somebody obviously used magic to send them back to wherever they came from, except for the dead ones."
"There's something else, too," Bevier added thoughtfully. "They were Lamorcs, and part of the upheaval in Lamorcand right now revolves around the stories that Drichtnoths returned. This attack makes it appear that those stories aren't just rumors and wild concoctions dreamed up late at night in some alehouse. Could Count Garrick be getting some help from a Styric magician? If Drichtnoth himself has actually been brought into the present, nothing's going to pacify the Lamorcs. They go up in flames at just the mention of his name."
"That's all very interesting, gentlemen," Elana told them. "But this wasn't just a random attack. We're a goodly distance from Lamorcand. So these antiques of yours went to a great deal of trouble to attack us
specifically. The real question here is why.
We'll work on finding an answer for you, Your Majesty, Tinian promised her.
Barret returned shortly before noon with 300 armored Pandions, and the rest of the journey to Kyrellos had some of the air of a military expedition. Their arrival in the Holy City and their stately march through the streets to the Basilica was very much like a parade, and it caused quite a stir. The Archprelate himself came out onto a second-floor balcony to watch their arrival in the square before the Basilica. Even from that distance, Sparhawk could clearly see that Dolmont's nostrils were white and his jaw was clenched. Elana's expression was regal and coolly defiant. Sparhawk lifted his daughter down from the carriage.
Don't wander off, he murmured into her small ear. There's something I need to talk with you about.
Later, she whispered back to him. I'll have to make peace between Dolmont and Mother first.
That'll be a neat trick.
Watch, Sparhawk, and learn.
The Archprelate's greeting was chilly, just this side of frigid, and he made it abundantly clear that he was just dying to have a nice long chat with the Queen of Alenia. He sent for his first secretary, the Patriarch Emban, and rather airily dropped the problem of making arrangements for Elena's entourage into the fat churchman's lap. Emban scowled and waddled away, muttering to himself. Then Dolmont invited the Queen and her prince consort into a private audience chamber. Mirtai stationed herself outside the door.
No hitting, she told Dolmont and Elana as they entered.
The small audience chamber was draped and carpeted in blue, and there were a table and chairs in the center.
Strange woman, that one, Dolmont murmured, looking back over his shoulder at Mirtai.
He took his seat and looked at Elana with a firm expression. Let's get down to business. Would you like to explain this, Queen Elana?
Of course, Archprelate Dolmont. She pushed his letter across the table to him. Just as soon as you explain this.
There was steel in her voice. He picked up the letter and glanced at it. It seems fairly straightforward. Which part of it didn't you understand? Things went downhill from there rather rapidly. Elana and Dolmont were on the verge of severing all diplomatic ties when the royal princess Danae entered the room, dragging the royal toy Rollo by one hind leg. She gravely crossed the room, climbed up into the archprelate's lap, and kissed him. Sparhawk had received quite a few of the kind of kisses his daughter bestowed when she wanted something, and he was well aware of just how devastatingly potent they were. Dolmont didn't really have much of a chance after that. I should have read through the letter before I had it dispatched, I suppose, he admitted grudgingly. Scribes sometimes overstate things.
Maybe I overreacted, Elana conceded. I had a great deal on my mind.
Dolmont's excuse had the tone of a peace offering.
I was irritable on the day when your letter arrived, Elana countered.
Sparhawk leaned back. The tension in the room had noticeably relaxed. Dolmont had changed since his elevation to the archprelacy. Always before, he had been a self-effacing man, so self-effacing, in fact, that his colleagues in the hierocracy had not even considered him for the highest post in the church until Elana had pointed out his many sterling qualities to them. The irony of that fact was not lost on Sparhawk. Now, however, Dolmont seemed to speak with two voices. The one was the familiar voice of their old friend. The other was the voice of the archprelate, authoritarian and severe. The institution of his office seemed to be gradually annexing their old friend. Sparhawk sighed. It was probably inevitable, but he regretted it all the same. Elana and the archprelate continued to apologize and offer excuses to each other. After a while, they agreed to respect one another, and they concluded their conference by agreeing to pay closer attention to the little courtesies in the future. Princess Danae, still seated in the archprelate's lap, winked at Sparhawk. There were quite a number of political and theological implications in what she had just done, but Sparhawk didn't really want to think about those. The reason for the peremptory summons that had nearly led to a private war between Elana and Dolmont had been the arrival of a high-ranking emissary from the Tamul Empire on the Darisian continent, that vast landmass lying to the east of Zemak. formal diplomatic relations between the Aline kingdoms of Eosia and the Tamul Empire of Derisia did not exist. The Church, however, routinely dispatched emissaries with ambassadorial rank to the imperial capital at Methyrian, in some measure because the three westernmost kingdoms of the empire were occupied by Alenes, and their religion differed only slightly from that of the Eosian Church. The emissary was a Tamil, a man of the same race as Mirtai, although she would have made at least two of him. His skin was the same golden bronze, his black hair touched with gray, and his dark eyes were up-tilted at the corners.
"He's very good," Dolmont quietly cautioned them, as they sat in one of the audience chambers, while M'Ban and the emissary exchanged pleasantries near the door. "In some ways, he's even better than M'Ban. Be just a little careful of what you say around him. Tamils are quite sensitive to the nuances of language." M'Ban escorted the silk-robed emissary to the place where they all sat. "Your Majesty, I have the honor to present His Excellency Ambassador Oscania, representative of the Imperial Court at Methyrian," the little fat man said, bowing to Elana.
"I swoon in Your Majesty's divine presence," the ambassador proclaimed with a florid bow.
"You don't really, do you, Your Excellency?" she asked him with a little smile.
"Well, not really, of course," he admitted with absolute aplomb. "I thought it might be polite to say it, though. Did it seem unduly extravagant? I am unversed in the usages of your culture."
"You'll do just fine, Your Excellency," she laughed.
"I must say, however, with Your Majesty's permission, that you're a devilishly attractive young lady. I've known a few queens in my time, and the customary compliments usually cost one a certain amount of wrestling with one's conscience." Ambassador Oscania spoke flawless Alenic.
"May I present my husband, Prince Sparhawk?" Elana suggested.
"The legendary Sir Sparhawk? Most assuredly, dear lady. I've traveled half round the world to make his acquaintance." "Well met, Sir Sparhawk," Oscania bowed.
"Your Excellency," Sparhawk replied, also bowing. Elana then introduced the others, and the ongoing exchange of diplomatic pleasantries continued for the better part of an hour. Oscania and Mirtai spoke at some length in the Tamil tongue, a language that Sparhawk found quite musical. "Have we concluded all the necessary genuflections and courtesies direction?" the ambassador asked at last. "Cultures vary, of course, but in Tamale, 3/4 of an hour is the customary amount of time one is expected to waste on polite trivialities."
"That seems about right to me, too," Stragan grinned. "If we overdo our homage to courtesy, she becomes a bit conceited and expects more and more obeisance every time."
"Well said, Milord Stragan," Oscania approved. "The reason for my visit is fairly simple, my friends. I'm in trouble." He looked around. "I pause for the customary gasps of surprise while you try to adjust your thinking to accept the notion that anyone could possibly find any fault in so witty and charming a fellow as I."
"I think I'm going to like him," Stragan murmured.
"You would," Ulaf grunted.
"Pray tell, Your Excellency," Elana said, "how on earth could anyone find reason to be dissatisfied with you?"
The ambassador's flowery speech was contagious. "I exaggerated slightly for effect," Oscania admitted. "I'm not really in all that much trouble. It's just that His Imperial Majesty has sent me to Kyrellos to appeal for aid, and I'm supposed to couch the request in such a way that it won't humiliate him." M'Ban's eyes were very, very bright. He was in his natural element here.
"I think the way we'll want to proceed here is to just lay the problem out on the table for our friends in bold, flat terms," he suggested, "and then they can concentrate on the real issue of avoiding embarrassment to the Imperial government. They're all unspeakably clever. I'm sure that if they put their heads together, they'll be able to come up with something."
Dolmont sighed.
"Was there no one else you could have selected for my job, Elana?" he asked plaintively.
Oscania gave the two of them a questioning look.
"It's a long story, Your Excellency," M'Ban told him. "I'll tell you all about it some day when neither of us has anything better to do.
Tell them what it is in Tamuli that's so serious that His Imperial Majesty had to send you here to look for help.
Promise not to laugh? Oscania said to Elana.
I'll do my best to stifle my guffaws, she promised.
We've got a bit of civil unrest in Tamuli, Oscania told them. They all waited.
That's it, Oscania confessed ruefully. Of course I'm quoting the Emperor verbatim, at his instruction. You'd almost have to know our Emperor to understand. He'd sooner die than overstate anything. He once referred to a hurricane as a little breeze, and the loss of half his fleet as a minor inconvenience.
Very well, Your Excellency, Elana said. Now we know how your Emperor would characterize the problem. What words would you use to describe it?
Well, Oscania said, since Your Majesty is so kind as to ask, catastrophic does sort of leap to mind. We might consider insoluble, cataclysmic, overwhelming, little things like that. I really think you should give some consideration to His Majesty's request, my friends, because we have some fairly strong evidence that what's happening on the Derisian continent may soon spread to Eosia as well. And if it does, it's probably going to mean the end of civilization as we know it. I'm not entirely positive how you Alenes feel about that sort of thing, but we Tamils are more or less convinced that some effort ought to be made to fend it off. It sets such a bad precedent when you start letting the world come to an end every week or so. It seems to erode the confidence people have in their governments for some reason.
Chapter 5 Ambassador Oscania leaned back in his chair.
Where to begin? He pondered. When one looks at the incidents individually, they almost appear trivial. It's the cumulative effect that's brought the Empire to the brink of collapse.
We can understand that sort of thing, Your Excellency, Amban assured him. The Church has been on the brink of collapse for centuries now. Our Holy Mother reels from crisis to crisis like a drunken sailor.
Amban, Dolmont chided gently.
Sorry, the fat little churchman apologized. Oscania was smiling.
Sometimes it seems that way, though, doesn't it, Your Grace? He said to Amban. I'd imagine that the government of the Church is not really all that much different from the government of the Empire. Bureaucrats need crisis in order to survive. If there isn't a crisis of some kind, someone might decide that a number of positions could be eliminated.
I've noticed the same sort of thinking myself, Amban agreed.
I assure you, however, that what we have in Tamuli is not some absurd little flap generated for the purposes of making someone's position secure. I'm not exaggerating in the slightest when I say that the Empire is on the brink of collapse.
His bronze face became thoughtful.
We are not one homogeneous people, as you here in Eosia are, he began. There are 5 races on the Derisian continent. We Tamils live to the east. There are Alenes in the west, Styrix around Sarsos, the Valesians on their island, and the Signescans in the center. It's probably not natural for so many different kinds of people to all be gathered under one roof. Our cultures are different, our religions are different, and each race is sublimely convinced that it's the crown of the universe. He sighed. We'd probably have been better off if we'd remained separate.
But at some time in the past, someone grew ambitious, Tinian surmised.
Far from it, Sir Knight. Oscania replied. You could almost say that we Tamils blundered into empire.
He looked at Mirtai, who sat quietly with Danae in her lap.
And that's the reason, he said, pointing at the giantess.
It wasn't my fault, Oscania, she protested. I wasn't blaming you personally, Etana, he smiled.
It's your people, she smiled.
I haven't heard that term since I was a child. No one's ever called me Etana before.
What's it mean? Talon asked her curiously.
Warrior. She shrugged.
Warrioress, actually, Oscania corrected. He frowned.
I don't want to be offensive, but your Alene tongue is limited in its ability to convey subtleties.
He looked at Elana. Has Your Majesty noticed that your slave is not exactly like other women? He asked her.
She's my friend. Elana objected. Not my slave.
Don't be ignorant, Elana, Mirtai told her crisply.
Of course I'm a slave. I'm supposed to be.
Go on with your story, Oskanya. I'll explain it to them later.
Do you really think they'll understand?
No, but I'll explain it anyway.
And there, revered Archprelate, Oskanya said to Dolmont, there lies the key to the empire. The Etons placed themselves in thrall to us some 1,500 years ago to prevent their homicidal instincts from obliterating their entire race. As a result, we Tamils have the finest army in the world, even though we're basically a non-violent people. We tended to win those incidental little arguments with other nations which crop up from time to time and are usually settled by negotiation. In our view, our neighbors are like children, hopelessly incapable of managing their own affairs. The empire came into being largely in the interests of good order. He looked around at the church knights. Once again, I'm not trying to be offensive, but war is probably the stupidest of human activities. There are much more efficient ways to persuade people to change their minds. Such as the threat to unleash the Etons? Emban suggested slyly. That does work rather well, Your Grace, Oskanya admitted. The presence of the Etons has usually been enough in the past to keep political discussion from becoming too spirited. Etons make excellent policemen. He sighed. You noted that slight qualification, I'm sure. I said, in the past. Unfortunately, that doesn't hold true anymore. An empire comprised of disparate peoples must always expect these little outbreaks of nationalism and racial discord. It's the nature of the insignificant to try to find some way to assert their own importance. And it's pathetic, but racism is generally the last refuge of the unimportant. These outbreaks of insignificance aren't normally too widespread, but suddenly all of Tamale is in the throes of an epidemic of them, everyone sewing flags and singing national anthems and laboring over well-honed insults to be directed at the yellow dogs. That's us, of course. He held out his hand and looked at it critically. Our skins aren't really yellow, you know. They're more... He pondered it. Beige? Stragan suggested.
That's not too flattering either, Milord Stragan. Oskanya smiled. Oh well, perhaps the Emperor will appoint a special commission to define our skin tone once and for all. He shrugged. At any rate, incidental outbreaks of nationalism and racial bigotry would be no real problem for the Etons, even if they occurred in every town in the Empire. It's the unnatural incidents that cause us all this concern.
I thought there might be more, Ulath murmured.
At first, these demonstrations of magic were directed at the people themselves, Oskanya went on. Every culture has its mythic hero, some towering personality who unified the people, gave them national purpose, and defined their character. The modern world is complex and confusing, and the simple folk yearn for the simplicity of the Age of Heroes, when national goals could be stated simply, and everyone knew precisely who he was. Someone in Tamale is resurrecting the heroes of antiquity.
Sparhawk felt a sudden chill. Giants? He asked.
Well, Oskanya considered it, perhaps that is the proper term at that. The passage of the centuries blurs and distorts, and our cultural heroes tend to become larger than life. I suppose that when we think of them, we do think of giants. That's a very acute perception, Sir Sparhawk.
I can't actually take credit for it, Your Excellency. The same sort of thing's been happening here.
Dolmont looked at him sharply.
I'll explain later, Sarathi. Please go on, Ambassador Oskanya. You said that whoever's stirring things up in Tamale started out by raising national heroes. That implies it's gone further.
Oh, yes indeed, Sir Sparhawk. Much, much further. Every culture has its hobgoblins as well as its heroes. It's the hobgoblins we've been encountering. Monsters, afreets, werewolves, vampires, all those things adults use to frighten children into good behavior. Our Etons can't cope with that sort of thing. They're trained to deal with men, not with all the horrors the creative genius of eons has put together. That's our problem. We have 9 different cultures in Tamale, and suddenly each one of them has taken to pursuing its traditional historic goals. When we send in our Etons to restore order and to reassert imperial authority,
the horrors rise up out of the ground to confront them. We can't deal with it. The Empire's disintegrating, falling back into its component parts. His Imperial Majesty's government hopes that your church can recognize a certain community of interest here. If Tamale collapses back into 9 warring kingdoms, the resulting chaos is almost certain to have its impact here in Eosia as well. It's the magic that has us so concerned. We can deal with ordinary insurrection, but we are unequipped to deal with a continent-wide conspiracy that routinely utilizes magic against us. The Styrix at Sarsos are baffled. Everything they try is countered almost before they can set it in motion. We've heard stories about what happened in the city of Zemach, and it is to you personally that I must appeal, Sir Sparhawk. Zelasta of Sarsos is the preeminent magician in all of Styricum, and he assures us that you are the only man in all the world with enough power to deal with the situation. Zelasta may have an exaggerated idea of my abilities, Sparhawk said. You know him? We've met. Actually, Your Excellency, I was only a very small part of what happened at Zemach. When you get right down to it, I was hardly more than a channel for power I couldn't even begin to describe. I was the instrument of something else. Be that as it may, you're still our only hope. Someone is quite obviously conspiring to overthrow the Empire. We must identify that someone. Unless we can get to the source of all this and neutralize it, the Empire will collapse. Will you help us, Sir Sparhawk? That decision's not mine to make, Your Excellency. You must appeal to my queen and to Sarathi here. If they command me, I'll go to Tamale. If they forbid it, I won't. I'll direct my enormous powers of persuasion at them, then. Oskania smiled. But even assuming that I'm successful, and there's little doubt that I shall be, we're still faced with an almost equally serious problem. We must protect His Imperial Majesty's dignity at all costs. An appeal from one government to another is one thing, but an appeal from His Majesty's government to a private citizen on another continent is quite another. That is the problem which must be addressed.
I don't see that we have any choice, Sarathi,
Emban was saying gravely. It was late evening. Ambassador Oskania had retired for the night, and the rest of them, along with Patriarch Ortsel of Kadok in Lamorkand, had gathered to give his request serious consideration.
We may not entirely approve of some of the policies of the Tamul Empire, but its stability is in our vital interest just now. We are fully committed to our campaign in Rendor. If Tamale flies apart, we'll have to pull most of our armies, and the Church Knights, out of Rendor to protect our interests in Zemach. Zemach's not much of a place, I'll grant you, but the strategic importance of its mountains can't be overstated. We've had a hostile force in those mountains for the past 2,000 years, and that fact has occupied the full attention of our Holy Mother. If we allow some other hostile people to replace the Zemachs, everything Sparhawk achieved in Otha's capital is lost. We'll go right back to where we were 6 years ago. We'll have to abandon Rendor again and start mobilizing to meet a new threat from the east.
You're stating the obvious, Emban, Dormont told him.
I know, but sometimes it helps to lay everything out so that we can all look at it.
Sparhawk, Dormont said then, if I were to order you to Mathurin, but your wife ordered you to stay home, what would you do? I'd probably have to go into a monastery to pray for guidance for the next several years. Our Holy Mother Church is overwhelmed by your piety, Sir Sparhawk. I do what I can to please her, Sarathi. I am her true knight, after all. Dolmont sighed. Then it all boils down to some sort of accommodation between Ilana and me, doesn't it? Such wisdom can only have come from God, Sparhawk observed to his companions. Do you mind? Dolmont said tartly.
Then he looked at the Queen of Alenia with a certain resignation.
Name your price, Your Majesty.
I beg your pardon?
Let's not tiptoe around each other, Ilana. Your champions put my back to the wall.
I know, she replied, and I'm so impressed with him that I can barely stand it. We'll have to discuss this in private, revered Archprelate.
We wouldn't want Sir Sparhawk to fully realize his true value, now would we? He might begin to get the idea that we ought to pay him what he's actually worth.
I hate this, Dolmont said to no one in particular.
I think we might want to touch briefly on something else, Stragan suggested. The Tamil ambassador's story had a certain familiar ring to it. Or was I the only one who noticed that? We've got a situation going on in Lamorkan that's amazingly similar to what's happening in Tamale. The Lamorks are all blithely convinced that Drichtnoth's returned, and that's almost identical to the situation Oskanya described. Then, on our way here from Simura, we were set upon by a group of Lamorks who could only have come from antiquity. Their weapons were steel, but their armor was bronze, and they spoke old Lamork. After Sir Ulof killed their leader, the ones who were still alive vanished. Only their dead remained, and they were all dried out. And that's not all, Sparhawk added. This spring, there were some bandits operating in the mountains of western Eosia. They were being led by some of Anaya's former supporters, and they were doing all they could to stir up rebellion among the peasantry. Platamy managed to get a spy into their camp, and he told us that the movement was being fueled by Krager, Martell's old underling. After we rounded them up, we tried to question one of them about Krager, and a cloud like the one we saw on our way to Zemok engulfed the man and tore him all to pieces. There's definitely something afoot here in Eosia, too, and it seems to be coming out of Lamorkand. So you think there's a connection? Dolmont asked him. It's a logical conclusion, Sarathi. There are too many similarities to be safely ignored. Sparhawk paused, glancing at his wife. This may cause a certain amount of domestic discontent, he said regretfully, but I believe we'd better think very seriously about Oskanya's request. Someone's harrowing the past to bring back people and things that have been dead for thousands of years. When we encountered this sort of thing in Pelosia, Sifrinia told us that only the gods were capable of that.
Well, that's not entirely true, Sparhawk, Bevier corrected him. She did say that a few of the most powerful Styric magicians could also raise the dead.
I think we can discount that possibility, Sparhawk disagreed. Sifrinia and I were talking about it once, and she told me that in the 40,000 years of Styric history, there have only been two Styrics who had the capability, and then only imperfectly. This raising of heroes and armies is happening in 9 nations in Tamale, and at least one here in Eosia. There are just too many similarities for it to be a coincidence, and the whole scheme, whatever its goal, is just too complex to have come from somebody who doesn't have an absolute grasp on the spell.
The troll gods? Ulof suggested bleakly.
I wouldn't discount the possibility. They did it once before, so we know that they have the capability. Right now, though, all we have are some suspicions based on some educated guesses. We desperately need information.
That's my department, Sparhawk, Stragan told him. Mine and Platamy's. You're going to Deresia, I assume?
It's beginning to look that way.
Sparhawk gave his wife an apologetic look. I'd gladly let someone else go, but I'm afraid he wouldn't know what he's looking for.
I'd better go with you, Stragan decided. I have associates there as well as here in Eosia, and people in our line of work can gather information much more quickly than your people can.
Sparhawk nodded.
Maybe we can start right there, Ulof suggested. He looked at the Patriarch Ortzel.
How did all these wild stories about Drichtnoth get started, Your Grace? Nobody's reputation really lasts for 4,000 years, no matter how impressive he was to begin with.
Drichtnoth is a literary creation, Sir Ulof, the severe blonde churchman replied, smiling slightly. End of Side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.